Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the All Things PA Education Podcast, an original podcast series produced by the PA Education Association, where we discuss trends, philosophies, programs, and issues directly impacting the profession. I'm your host and CEO of PAEA, Sarah Fletcher. This month's episode is sponsored by PA Excel. Our guest today is Casey Johnson. Casey is psychometrician here for PAEA. Casey's been here a little over a year and a half and has brought such tremendous value and expertise to both the association and our members. Casey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Happy to be here.
So, Casey, you've brought tremendous value, to say the least, tons of expertise through our portfolio of assessments. I've had the privilege of working with you, but most of our listeners have not. For those who may not know you or what a psychometrician is, why don't you tell us a little about that?
Of course. Starting with what a psychometrician is. If you want to break it down, the Greek term for psycho is brain, and metrician is to measure. So a psychometrician measures the brain. There are more technical ways of doing that now as far as EKGs or CAT scans, but what we're really concerned with is what people know. And so we develop tests and assessments to help try to identify what a person knows. And so that can span the whole gambit of the math and reading assessment all the way up to higher cognitive level learning, surgery, literally brain surgery, rocket science. So it runs the whole gambit there.
One of the things I've loved about working with you, and I hope all of our members get to interact with you, because just like you just broke down psychometrician, you are so good at breaking these really complex concepts, especially to a lay person like me, who I will tell you got through statistics courses on a wing and a prayer mostly, but you do such a good job of breaking it down into the most simple form and make things so easily translatable and understandable. So thank you.
I joke with some of my colleagues that we have to put on both the structural engineer hat, the construction foreman, the mechanic, sometimes the custodian, and then the relationship builder throughout. So it's putting on all those hats to do the whole realm of assessments and making sure people understand why we have assessments. A lot of people going through school hated assessments, hated taking tests. And so that puts us at a disadvantage coming into any conversation because people have that negative feeling about assessments.
I can't argue with you there totally, although I can say you have definitely changed my thinking on the world of assessment. Speaking of, let's start to unpack assessment. It is obviously a big, covers a lot of complex concepts, to say the least. Tell me, from your psychometric point of view, how the different assessments contribute to evaluating student performance. For example, I know the well-known ones take the PANTS and the PACRAT and, of course, end of curriculums and end of rotations. But how do those different assessments really contribute to evaluating student performance?
Very good question there. Thinking of PANTS, that's probably the ultimate pinnacle goal for all PA students, to ultimately pass the PANTS, get out into the field. So that is a huge summative culmination exam. But we at PAEA have developed a bunch of pre-summative, but I would consider our EOC, our end of curriculum exam, a summative assessment over their entire educational experience as a PA student. Really that final cutoff line before people graduate. Then thinking about our PACRAT and EORs, they can be both a formative assessment of, especially the PACRAT, how people take the assessment, get their feedback. They can think of what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, where they need to do better, where they need to seek additional help at. While the EORs weren't originally designed for that purpose, they were supposed to be at the end of a rotation to see if you summatively finished your rotation and the knowledge you need. It also provides that keyword feedback and developmental feedback that you might need to work harder on certain areas to be prepared for that EOC and eventually for the PANTS. So it serves that dual role of both a formative and a summative assessment in that case.
That's really helpful. And just for a moment, if we can go there, because you're right, I do recall the end of rotations and their original rollout really being that summative for each of the rotations. But if I was going to use it for a formative assessment, what might that look like? Or at least what might I want to consider about using it in that way?
I would take a cross-exam look at it. Historically, students, their first end of rotation score tend to be a little bit lower because it's a higher stakes exam that students aren't used to. And as they progress through multiple rotations, their scores tend to improve. I would take a cross-sectional approach to looking at those exams. And if the first exam students were poor at cardiovascular questions, the third exam they were poor at cardiovascular exams, their last one they were poor at cardiovascular exams, that's an underlying trend that that student needs to probably bolster their learning or remediation in that topic to be prepared for further advancements. Look at it at a holistic approach.
And on that note, and maybe you're saying this, maybe you are not, but I just want to drill down into that because I think that's a powerful recommendation and taking that long view. If I were going to offer, let's say, exam on cardiology, to use your example, it sounds like I might want, from a formative aspect, want to offer that a couple of times throughout the student's clinical year to in order to get that comparison. Is that what you're alluding to?
And almost all of our end of rotations have some cardiovascular questions in there. Taking all of your end of rotation exams are going to give you some of that information. We also recommend supplementing some of those EORs with your own quizzes or exams or end of rotation exams. And if you find out students are lacking in certain areas, maybe add more weight to those questions or the number of questions in assessing those students.
That's really powerful advice. And actually, you bring me to something that I wanted to tease out a little bit. Obviously, all too well, as the person who leads this area, the assessment area, let's say how the sausage is made in terms of the end of curriculum, end of rotation, and PAPRAT exam. Obviously, a lot goes into those. And then you just mentioned programs supplementing with their own exams. I guess I'd like to hear a little bit about both. What makes the exams that PAEA makes, how are they maybe different than the ones that the programs develop on their own?
Another great question, Sarah. The PAEA really hopes to alleviate some of the burden because those end of curriculum exams are truly high stakes exams at the very end of coursework. And so getting those wrong could have devastating effects on both the industry and the people that were graduating. Again, going back to my earlier example of being a structural engineer, if we're building a skyscraper and at the very end get something wrong, there could be devastating consequences. If you're building a doghouse in your backyard, the consequences of something like that going wrong are maybe more personal, but less high stakes.
Right.
When it comes to programs building their own quizzes and maybe even end of course exams, the stakes are high for those individual students, but the stakes aren't as high for the 10,000 PA students across the country. We try to take pride in our cross-university exams like end of curriculum and end of rotations that alleviate some of the burden from programs having to do that high-stakes testing themselves, and then they can focus on the individual needs of their students, making high-quality exams specific for their cohorts.
That's really helpful, and I certainly appreciate the kind of metaphor about the skyscraper and the doghouse, though, like you said, personally, yes, we want our dogs to be safe too, but I think that's a really important point on the scale and scope of impact we would have. The other thing, again, I have the advantage, of course, and firsthand, all that goes into making those high-stakes exams that probably also maybe make them somewhat different. Can you talk just a little bit? I know we don't nearly have the time to go through the whole production, but what are those critical tasks or critical key points in terms of making those exams that are really important from a psychometric point of view and that really take the time and the you said to get right?
A brief overview of our production schedule. We start item writing with our cohorts in May, and they have 3 months to write really high quality items for us. On average, people say it takes about 45 minutes to write a high quality item, and we're writing 1,000 of them in a year. So that's a huge time devotion from our volunteers, but on the other end, that's a huge time savings for programs not having to dedicate thousands of hours to writing exams. Once they're written in a year, we pre-test them with all students, making sure that they're accurate, valid. We analyze those stats and then are building comprehensive exams that have both difficult items, easy items, and then almost a perfect bell curve distribution of abilities. So that way we're testing students everywhere. While that's a almost 2.5 year procedure to get all of that information that lends credence, validity, and reliability to our exams, that most programs can't dedicate the resources to do that. So we're glad that we can provide such a high level exams.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about 45 minutes per question. Certainly, if we didn't have our volunteers, we would not have the quantity, quality, or any even the assessment program. But you also bring up another good point. In addition to having the time, to your point, and really having that dedicated resourcing to the production schedule, et cetera, we also, like I said, are fortunate to have you and, of course, Robbie Furter, two psychometricians. That's not the norm in most programs, specifically having a dedicated full-time psychometrician or even sometimes person for assessment specifically. What advice do you have for the programs that really don't have these resources when making or program-specific exams?
I would highly recommend attending Faculty Skills 101, and we also offer, us and NCCPA both offer item writing courses and item analysis courses, which are a great starter for things. I would also encourage you to work with somebody writing items and building exams. Two minds are always better than one. You may think you're a great item writer. Every year we have about 10 new volunteers come into our item writing process. They all submit items. They're good quality items. But anecdotally, they say at the end of our workshops, they thought they were good item writers until they went through this process. And they just learned that it's like any skill, the more you use it, the sharper that skill becomes. And being surrounded by other people sharpening your skill makes you that much better. So I always encourage a buddy system, work with other people, learn from them, let them pick up where you have weakness and where they have weaknesses, you help them.
Yeah, absolutely. I can say as an educator, obviously not a PA educator, as an educator over the years, definitely had this, I guess I'll say, misperception that I was able to write good items just naturally. And then, like you said, when you get around more than one set of eyes, it's certainly, I think we just had our 10th annual exam development summit, multiple eyes. It really is a humbling experience. But like you said, a great learning experience as well. On that note, when it comes to just for a minute in item writing, and I wanted to cover a lot more, but what does it take to write a really high quality item? You mentioned the buddy system and things like that, but, or at least from your psychometric point of view, what are some of the things that trip people up and they don't necessarily understand what makes a really good discerning item, things like that?
Great question. We come across this often. We have our blueprints published on our website and people can go and look at our blueprints that kind of guide how we're writing exams. The one hindrance there is if you're trying to write a very specific item to a both a medical condition and a task area, you may start pigeonholing some of your thoughts and you write this beautiful, wonderful item. We get to review and then the 10 people in the room all come up with a different correct answer to that question because you were writing it to a specific topic and then they're seeing it for the first time, don't know what the topic is, and they can come up with multiple interpretations of the scenario that you came up with. Having those outside views, we have our both small group review, we have editors looking at items, and then again, we'll have a statistical review of the items once they're launched. And even 10 faculty members getting together, staring at an item, coming to a consensus of what the correct answer is. When it goes out into the wild, you may find that no student understands it, or there's a particular word in there that triggers students to think of a completely different topic and go in a different direction. So getting that statistical feedback from items of what's both our interpretation, but what's the student's interpretation really lends credence to what a good item is. And sometimes you just don't know until it goes live.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our episode sponsor, PA Excel. Looking for didactic and clinical year solutions all in one place? PA Excel focuses specifically on your program success with PANTS Review, in-person clinical rotations, virtual second year student resources, and so much more. PA Excel is proud to announce their PA Prep Academy, a novel program which arms incoming students with digital note-taking, resiliency strategies, study styles and habits, lecture note mastery, intentional note-taking, time management, study skills and organization, metacognition, memory and recall, reading comprehension, maximizing study groups, test-taking skills, and so much more. Visit paexcel.com today for more information. Before we jump over to more of the scores and things like that, you raise an issue that I'm just curious to know a little bit about. In terms of assessments, obviously done for the right reasons and there to guide learning, et cetera, I think there might be some potential for harm if you're not sure what you're doing You want to help with that a little bit?
Yes. As an assessment department, we're always thinking do no harm and only assess upon matters that we need to assess on. But that's always a very difficult topic to tease out because we're preparing people for the real world. So we're trying to ask them real world scenarios. But some of those topics could be triggering in ways that we don't anticipate. And so I think trying to keep the exams of the highest quality is something that we're very concerned with when we start looking at some of our things. We think from the item level up. So if our bricks in the wall, our items, are quality and minimally invasive, we're not asking in-depth questions, we're not putting extraneous details in there that might trigger students in a way not intended, and we do enough of those, we're trying to reduce harm and reduce bias. And then this year alone, we introduced a new cultural humility and item writing group, our CHIA group. And yes, in my head, I do the CHIA song every time I say
too.
That. But the great acronym, we are easy to remember, but they've been instrumental in looking at our items, trying to identify bias. We introduced them this year in our item writing cycle. So they came in halfway through. We're looking at over 1,000 items, trying to identify problems. And we've had really engaging conversations about, is it your parents bring you in versus is it your mother? And if it's always your mother bringing in, are we introducing some bias of people that weren't raised with a mother? Or are we gender tagging people that only a mother can bring in a child versus a father or multiple fathers? It's a conversation that we are glad to have because if we can fix it at the item stage, that is hopefully going to remove some bias from students when they take the test. We don't want that error involved because of that triggering situation. We'd rather know whether they know the medical knowledge.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you went there because so much intentionality and just like you said, just at a single, like how you likened it to a brick and a wall, just a single item, taking all that thought, not just from the psychometric and that angle, but like you said, really thinking about it in through a DEI lens, cultural, humility and things of that nature. So thank you for that, Casey. All right. To zoom up a level, I guess, one of the topics that you've heard a lot about, certainly in our whole assessment team, is programs wanting to understand about scores and how they translate and everything from cut scores to Z scores and things of that nature. So I'll just open it up and ask you to start at the basics. Where do we start with this conversation?
Let's start with what a scaled score is, because okay, that's the first thing that students are going to see once they get their scores back. The simple psychometric answer is that our scaled scores are a simple transformation of a score onto a new scale, hence the word scaled score. We do this for a number of reasons, and a lot of the reasons are psychometric in nature. So if we look underneath the hood briefly, we're doing an IRT modeling of our items, the difficulty, and the discrimination of our items. I would be happy to talk to any of the listeners if they want to go into what a logistic regression is and why we are using it on our items. But again, it's a lot of math that's involved there. The reason we do that is so we can identify items. Are they discriminating? Are people that do well on the test getting this item correct, or students that are doing poorly on this test getting the item wrong? We would like to see that. We would hate to see the inverse relationship for students that are doing poorly on the test are the only ones able to get an item correct. That generally means something's wrong with the item.
Right.
And then so our logistic regression formula ends up spitting out a number like the score on an EOC might be 0.83. Telling a student that they made them 0.83 on a test is not very meaningful and we would propose a lot of questions to the students. So we ended up scaling that and are seeing those scales go from 1,200 to 1,800, and that 0.83 ends up being a 1,455 on every single test, whether they took it in 2020, whether they took it in 2022, or whether they took it this year.
Okay.
So we have that strict underlying difficulty measurement of our exams. Where we start getting into slight differences is whenever we start reporting mean scores. So any given cohort could have a higher mean or a lower mean just given on the year. but what a 415 means this year is the exact same thing of what it meant last year.
And that's really helpful what I'm hearing you say. If I'm a program and that score means the same thing, like you said, regardless of my cohort, my year, because on the back end, you and the people who are smart, you are doing the math and all this. If I'm a program, is it safe to say I can take that score and now translate it into what it means in my program, for example? What does that mean in terms of I'm passing, I'm failing, things like that?
Yes, that is a great way to go about it. I know many faculty are concerned with, I have to give a grade back to the university and it has to be on a 0 to 100 scale. Us telling them that it's a 1455 is problematic because the university is not going to accept that. So we know there's a number of universities out there and institutions that end up using the mean and standard deviations that we report to create Z scores, to transform them into what the scales should be. We would also like, and Sarah, we can talk about this more offline, but if we're having more instructional designers and growth and what our learning outcomes are going to be as an organization, teaching people how to do many standard settings of a 1450 is going to equal an 85 in our coursework, right, and then a 1500 would equal a 92, and start setting where those cuts are and leaving them for 2, 3, 4 years at a time, because you don't want to have a knee-jerk reaction in changing things just because you had one really smart cohort come through or you had a poor cohort come through. You'd like this to be a steady baseline for your programs. So that's the one detractor of using a mean and standard deviation to create a Z-score. That mean does change year over year, so you might be slightly fluctuating that cut. We've historically looked at them, and they don't fluctuate greatly, but there is some fluctuation in there. So it's something to be aware of using those Z-scores.
Okay, that's very helpful, Casey. And you raise, again, back to the unintended consequences, and dare I say, kind of harm, but certainly if you're that student who's sitting on the line and you happen to be, like you said, measured that year that the mean is really high, you probably are the person going, hey, wait a minute, this is highly anxiety-provoking and perhaps maybe unfair, but I'm glad to see that PAEA, you know, keeps an eye on that. And certainly if we saw something way outside the norm, we would be able to inform the programs. And I'm glad you mentioned, because obviously this is not going to be where we do a math lesson conversationally, but PAEA putting more resources behind being able to do some instruction and really, you know, teaching about these different scores so that programs can see those in a visual and audio way. So beyond just thinking about that level of score, what about cut scores a little bit more?
Cut scores are really what it all comes down to, a pass or fail mark for both the NCCPA exam, PANTS, and for our EOC exam. We conducted a very exhaustive analysis back in 2018, 2019, a standard setting process, and that was utilizing a bookmark method statistical analysis, which was, I wasn't here at the time, reading through the technical manual on it, very interesting process. And I'll put in a little plug because we'll be redoing a standard setting in 2025. So listeners, if you think that it'd be a very fun process, please volunteer. We'll essentially have between 40 and 50 volunteers come through. They will take the examination. They'll see what their score would be on the examination. And then we'll go through each item from the easiest item to the most difficult item, trying to identify where that minimum student should be able to get their knowledge. It's a fun and learning process. It's also kind of eye-opening because a lot of faculty will say, oh yeah, the cut score should be here. And then we'll pull up what their score was. And then they're probably below that cut. And they'll realize, oh, I overestimated what a student should know because I didn't perform that one. I've been doing PA position forever now. So it's both enlightening from an education standpoint from students and faculty, but it's also kind of level setting of where the industry should be, an understanding what a PA student should know.
Casey, I'm so glad we're wrapping up on this note, because certainly you just mentioned the fun and the enlightening part of assessment, and you have brought that to the table, certainly for me, but I can say for so many others through, like you said, our volunteers, our own staff, and really, I think just because there is so much to learn, I really do encourage anybody listening who wants to get involved, like you said, volunteer, be an item writer. The faculty development that comes with item writing is just tremendous. And like you said, there's some opportunities that are very specific, the one forthcoming about the standard setting, the cultural humility and item writing, so many opportunities really to learn and take it back to your program. So thank you so much for your time today and all your knowledge and wisdom you've shared with me and our listeners. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Again, we'd like to extend a special thank you to our episode sponsor, PA Excel. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And don't forget to check out PAEA's other podcasts for PA education professionals, The PA Path, a podcast where PAs, PA students, and current PAs can learn more about the profession and the paths the PAs take to serve their communities, and the JPAE podcast, a podcast where we meet one-on-one with authors of featured articles from the Journal of PA Education.